TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. We've got Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder in the studio. Hey, Forrest.
Hey, man.
Also with us is politics writer Christopher Hooks. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Jonathan.
And by phone, we're joined by staff writer Emily DePrang. How you doing?
Doing well.
Awesome. Later in the program, we'll be joined by former Observer managing editor and current freelance writer Michael May to talk about his new story, The Freedom Files, about a group of exonerees from Dallas who have launched their own detective agency to help innocent prisoners. But first, we have some news to discuss. We've spent a lot of time on the show talking about the gubernatorial race, and this week is no exception. There's quite a bit going on at the moment. Chris, let's start with you. What kind of week is Greg Abbott having?
Well, not that good, I would think. The biggest thing is that he's finally given Wendy Davis an issue that she can run on, which is there's been an ongoing kind of debate or struggle between the two over equal pay laws. Wendy Davis authored a bill last session of the legislature that would make it easier for women to sue over discriminatory pay in Texas. It was a signature effort of hers, and for a couple of weeks she's been trying to draw in Greg Abbott to a conflict over whether he would veto the bill like Perry did ultimately last session. And it seems, for reasons that are difficult for me to understand, it seems that he's kind of given in on this and agreed to engage her on this issue. So the last week you've had a couple of lieutenants of Abbott's, supporters of his, people like the executive director of the Red State Women PAC, and even the executive director of the Republican Party of Texas engage over this issue in ways that have not been beneficial for them.
So he wouldn't. First of all, he wouldn't answer the question: would you alt veto, like Perry did, an equal pay bill were to come across your desk as governor? He just refused to answer the question until this week, and then finally he relented and said, "Yes, I would veto the bill."
And it sounds like it's not clear why he relented and did that.
Well, the timing is interesting.
Ultimately, it happened a couple of hours after the San Antonio Express News came out with an investigative study of how people in his office, men and women in his office, were paid.
Right.
And it turns out that there's some kind of there's fodder for people who say that he was discriminatory in his own pay practices in his office. The article looked at about 700 assistant attorney generals.
Mm-hmm.
Found about a $6,000 discrepancy between men and women in that same position who were hired by him.
Does the fact that we do not have a state Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, that was the piece of legislation that Perry vetoed, does that mean that it would be harder for women in Abbott's office, for example, to sue for discrimination based on the basis of pay and gender?
Well, I suppose...
We're not lawyers, but...
Yeah. Me, definitely not. I guess I'm a little unsure how it would work with state employees. Davis's argument about the state Lilly Ledbetter Act has been that it would make it easier for women to sue. You could sue in the state courts instead of the federal courts is the main issue.
Right.
As well as there's a statute of limitations loophole kind of that would be closed by the act. I suppose it's always been a little unclear to me how many people that it would actually affect or help, but it would be... I guess the flip side of that is that it's hard for me to think of an argument against it.
Of course, if the reach is not so great, then what is the point of vetoing it? I mean, what you hear from both Perry and Abbott is that we don't want to create a situation where there's, you know, frivolous lawsuits, and we already have laws on the books that deal with discrimination.
Well, the point of passing it and the point of vetoing it are the same, which is the principle of the thing. And so by making Abbott come out and acknowledge that the principle is not important enough to him or is not enough of a priority, and that's hitting him where it hurts, which is in this question of whether or not women are going to come out and force for Wendy Davis. And then you've got the Red State Women making a great debut. Chris, do you remember the quote? What was it? That women are too busy to sue? Was that Red State?
It's funny to me, the idea that women are too busy is the thing that kind of escaped from that interview, but that segment of the interview is about 30 seconds long. It's difficult to watch. It's hard to describe what happened, really. it's a busy cycle for women. It was tough.
And that interview was with whom?
Sorry?
I'm sorry, that interview was with whom?
Carrie Chrisman, the executive director of Red State PAC, and Jason Whitley in Dallas.
Well, and Chris, you dug into Red State PAC a little bit. They kind of made a big splash. They got a write-up in Politico. They're supposed to be part of this broader kind of GOP outreach to women in particular. And it was kind of an interesting collection of women, and I think a man or two, that's actually behind Red State Women. They have some things in common, I guess. What did you find exactly?
Well, the subtext of this is that it's a kind of deliberate attempt from Republicans and a couple of Mike Toomey and Dave Carney, who runs the Attorney General Greg Abbott's campaign.
Well, Carney's a longtime operative. I mean, he's Rick Perry's. He kind of helped make Rick Perry's career. Guy lives in New Hampshire, but has worked in Texas a lot.
Republicans need groups like Red State Women, and the people that they got to kind of come together to run it, it's primarily a collection of lobbyists, ex-lobbyists, and legislative staffers, staffers of far-right representatives like Warren Goldman, Senator Kelly Hancock, people that were intimately involved in the measures that decimated women's healthcare programs in the state, and voted against equal pay laws. It's a strange assortment of people to run a women's advocacy group.
Sorry, my question is, what's surprising about that? Because I mean, if it's created as an outreach effort, it's not a true grassroots effort, and it's not like the Republican Party is trying to distance itself from its anti-choice legislation or cutting women's health or obviously pushing back on equal pay. I mean, I can't think of a reason why they wouldn't trot out women who professionally or personally or both support the kinds of issues that they think drive women away or that people think drive women away. I mean, I would think that they're trying to say these are positions that, that what the Republican Party stands for in Texas is something that women also support.
Well, in the outreach efforts, the PR efforts conducted by Red State Women so far, the peculiar thing to me is that there hasn't really been an emphasis on that. They did a video interview with Christy Craddock that was two and a half minutes of Christy Craddock talking about her family and her raising her kids and what it was like to grow up as the daughter of Tom Craddock. And the emphasis, the focus has been very soft. It's been a kind of...
One of the things that's weird to me, though, is, I mean, Red State Women, okay, women, the name suggests that this is somehow representative of Republican women or women in a Republican state, and really it's just, it's kind of a collection of, second and third tier political operatives. I mean, these are not people that are engaged in a whole lot more than basically, internal partisan politics. So it doesn't seem like a great face to put on the Republican outreach efforts to women, and not to mention that, yes, obviously, the state Republican Party and its constituent members have been responsible for a lot of the legislation around abortion restrictions and cutting family planning. If I was running for governor as a Republican against a strong general election candidate, Democrat, in this case, Wendy Davis, I think I would be running away from some of that. Or at least not going out of my way to alienate moderate voters. And that, to me, that kind of goes back to the equal pay thing, which I really do not understand why Greg Abbott decided to really double down on that. I don't see what they gain. I mean...
Don't you think he was just trying to close off the issue? I mean, it wasn't really doubling down. It was just... acknowledging what everybody already knew, and then trying to end the story, don't you think?
No, I don't. Well, doubling down is probably not the right phrase. But again, I mean, he wouldn't answer the question, which to me is kind of a, you know, is not a good thing. It sort of shows weakness. And then when he did, I think he gave the wrong answer. I don't think that was smart when Perry did it. I don't think it's smart now that Greg Abbott is doing it. And I don't expect them, you know, I don't expect him to be, you know, a code pinker or something. But I think what we're seeing from Greg Abbott is that they have made a strategic decision that they are not going to compromise, and they are going to run basically a pretty far to the right campaign. I think some of this is probably coming from Dave Carney, and that's just how he does it. And it's been somewhat successful. It's been successful in the past, so why change anything now?
And I guess that's also what's strange to me about this is now that Greg Abbott has said this, reporters are going to be going around to other Republicans running races and asking them about this. It's going to become an issue that kind of sustains itself going forward. And you saw today, this afternoon, Dan Patrick was asked this question in Dallas, and of course he said that he would veto it as well. So you're going to see this continuing forward. If the goal for the Abbott campaign was to shut this down, I don't think they went about it in a good way.
Is this something voters care about?
I think
they know.
Ultimately, the voters will decide.
Oh my God! You're not allowed to say
I don't. I don't know. I mean, you know, we usually use polls to talk about this, and I don't have any polls at my fingertips. But I just think on the equal pay thing. I mean, again, the Texas legislature. This is not some bastion of, you know, feminist radicalism or something. Passed this Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act with a, you know, fairly wide margins, effectively for the legislature. It's about allowing women who have discrimination claims to go to our state courts and try to seek redress. It seems to me like for your hypothetical kind of moderate voter, especially a woman, many of whom have experienced this type of discrimination, that somebody that's going out of their way to try to knock that type of thing down is kind of a, you know, just kind of a, it'd give me pause, I guess. Again, it's hard to get in the minds of the voters in that sense, but just thinking it through, it seems kind of potentially alienating.
Well, we have a little bit of time left, and Emily, I know that you have another piece of bad news for Greg Abbott this week. Do you mind bringing that up?
Yes, he got a little bit of a whooping from Texas's highest criminal court yesterday. So the backstory is that in 2005, lawmakers passed this law saying you can't sext with a minor. Adults can't do this, you know, sexually explicit texts back and forth with a minor. And the trouble is, in October, the Court of Criminal Appeals ruled unanimously that the law was unconstitutional because it was too broad. It banned things that would be considered free speech, that saying that, you know, things that are indecent but not obscene, sexual expression that's indecent but not obscene, you know, is consumed by minors, and you can't ban that, you can't criminalize it, and everything that they were intending to criminalize is already criminalized. So you can't solicit a minor, you can't harass them. So they said, no, you know, this law, we get what you're trying to do, but you need to do a way better job. And they threw it out. Well, Greg Abbott, who had kind of made this a big deal, went back and asked for a rehearing. The grounds on which he asked for this was saying that in 2011, lawmakers passed this law, and part of it was that if they were going to hear the constitutional grounds of a Texas law, if they were going to hear about a Texas law on grounds of constitutionality, that they had to tell the Attorney General and wait 45 days before issuing their final ruling, the idea being it gives the Attorney General time to do stuff and to defend the law. So anyway, Greg Abbott said, well, you didn't tell me you were going to rule on the constitutionality of this sexting law that I love, so you should do a rehearing. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said, unanimously, no, we're not going to do a rehearing. And also, this whole having to tell you when we're hearing the constitutionality thing is unconstitutional. So you can't have that anymore.
Well, thanks for sharing that story.
Sure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. And joining us now via the magic of telephonic communication is former Observer Managing Editor Michael May. Michael has a new story on TexasObserver.org called The Freedom Files, which focuses on a group of exonerees from Dallas who have launched their own detective agency to help innocent prisoners. Michael, can you give us a more detailed sense of this story?
Sure. Well, I started following this group of guys who are led by an exoneree named Chris Scott through an Observer story that I did in 2011, I believe, called The Freedom Fighters. And the story at that time was really about how this group of exonerees had come together, sort of as really like a self-help group. They, you know, were, you know, these guys are pretty amazing. Every time someone gets exonerated, they're there at the courthouse. They greet them. They give them money to make sure that they can get on their feet before their compensation from the state comes in. And so it sort of started like that, with like exonerees helping each other. And then over the years, it's just gotten more and more sophisticated. They started lobbying the Texas legislature for different, you know, for both things that really affected exonerees, like the amount of compensation and health insurance, and then larger criminal justice issues like eyewitness identification procedure, which is something they all feel really strongly about because they were convicted largely on the basis of faulty eyewitness IDs. And when I did that story, when I spoke to Chris Scott, he mentioned to me that he had this vision of putting together a detective agency and opening up other cases like his, which are non-DNA cases. He was the first exoneree to be released in Dallas without DNA evidence, which was quite a risky political move on the DA's part, Craig Watkins, who has been instrumental in releasing these guys. But, you know, it's one thing to do it when there's DNA evidence. That's kind of black and white. Like, look, we have evidence, you know, someone else committed this murder or this rape or whatever. But in Chris Scott's case, it was much more complicated and was much more drawn out. They found the perpetrator was in prison in Texas and confessed to the crime and said that Chris Scott had nothing to do with it. And, you know, they went through lie detector tests and et cetera, reopened the case, looked at the evidence, and he finally got out. But, he knows how difficult those cases are. And, in fact, a lot of innocence projects, shy away from non-DNA cases because it's such an uphill battle.
And yet, what is it, something like 90% of the cases are non-DNA? So,
yeah. So obviously there's a lot of innocent people out there who don't have DNA to test.
Right.
You know, and even cases that there were once DNA evidence, there is no guarantee that police departments and prosecutors kept this evidence. That's another thing that's very unique about Dallas, which is why there's such a high concentration of exonerees in Dallas, is that, you know, for all of Dallas's faults, you know, in putting these people away, they did keep the evidence. That is not true, for instance, in Harris County. Like, you're never going to see the number of exonerees in Houston like there are in Dallas. So,
is that just a factor of time, or is there something else in play here?
No. It's really that whoever did the Dallas Crime Lab, like, really, you know, had a good archival system and thought that this stuff may be useful at some point, because when they were collecting, you know, all the evidence, you know, for these exonerees, for these particular guys that I interviewed, were all, you know, collected before the era of DNA evidence. So, you know, it was very, you know, forward thinking on Dallas's part to keep that evidence. Other places just didn't think that was a priority, and then there's probably just kind of human disorganization as well.
So what's so interesting about your story is you're following these guys, and you're also making a film, and you're following these Dallas exonerees around while they basically look for cases. They're trying to find people who are wrongfully convicted in prison and in instances where there's not DNA, and basically trying to help them become exonerated, to get exonerated. So in your story, you're looking at one case in particular that the Dallas exonerees have come across and been working on. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that case.
So just to clarify, the film, which is called Freedom Fighters, there's a trailer online, is directed by Jamie Meltzer, not by myself. I'm a producer on it.
Just a producer, okay.
Following, there's been several cases now that the exonerees have looked at. And, the more that they are out there and doing this work, the more they get contacted by people in prison who claim they are innocent. And it's been an interesting process. So we got a letter from a man named Isaiah Hill. Isaiah Hill is actually illiterate, so he didn't write the letter. His cellmate wrote it. But it was a really compelling story that resonated with the other guys' experiences. So we had an eyewitness who admitted in court, and we got the transcripts and verified this, that he wasn't sure that was the guy when he was first questioned by the police. He only remembered, it was his recollection was pretty fuzzy. He remembered that the guy was wearing like a gaudy ring and like a silky shirt. It was all very vague.
Right. And Isaiah, the man who is in prison that they're trying to help, his name is Isaiah Hill, and he was convicted in the 70s, right, the late 70s, essentially robbing a motel or hotel in Brownwood, Texas, with a knife. And he's doing
life
in prison, isn't that right? Because it was his third felony.
Yeah, he is still in prison, which, I think we all know that Texas has certainly gone through long eras of tough on crime, but I have to say I was pretty shocked that a crime where nobody was hurt, you stole about or whoever it did it stole, we know it's a male, so yes, he stole about $150. So it's, kind of mind-boggling that this guy is still in prison. This was during the three strikes, you're out era. And he had two prior convictions, also for robbery. So, we went to visit Isaiah Hill in prison, and I've done, a fair number of prison interviews, and this one was different. Isaiah Hill was a man who was just completely broken down by the system. I don't know how else to describe it. He was he told us that he had had some form of like mental retardation, and there was some elements of that. Like he just was seemed very confused and not particularly articulate. He kind of spoke in circles and such, and he had been raped in prison shortly after his conviction, and told us that he had filed a case against the Texas prisons with David Ruiz, who I'm sure many observer know or readers know as the man who challenged the constitutionality of the Texas prison system and created a lot of reforms. Anyway, Isaiah Hill says that he was in federal prison for much of his time in prison, and had only recently come back to Texas, where he's eligible for parole. He has some disciplinary issues on his record, but beyond that, it's just that fact alone that he's eligible for parole, but Texas is keeping him sitting in a prison cell is shocking. I would also say from just my impression of Isaiah Hill that he would need a lot of help if he was released. I mean, this was a guy who spent like the vast majority of his life now in prison and would need support.
But the burning question at the center of all this, especially for the Dallas exonerees, is this man in prison for a crime that he did not commit?
Right. And the problem with looking at a crime from this old, as we learned the hard way, is it's probably going to be impossible to really know. Many of the witnesses are dead. His defense attorney, he actually had a good, apparently, I mean, at least from what I can tell reading the transcripts, that his defense attorney did quite a good job. His defense attorney was Lynn Neighbors, who became a representative in the Texas House. He's dead. He died quite young. I've spoken to the prosecutor, who, by the way, expressed shock that Isaiah Hill was still in prison. But that's really the only person so far connected to the case that we've been able to track down. The main eyewitness, the one whose testimony was quite shaky on the stand, we've been trying to trace him across the country. He left Texas, and we think we may have an address for him now. So that's, you know, so we are following up on that. But it's difficult. It's really difficult.
And this goes back to the nature, like you were talking about earlier, the nature of non-DNA cases is that they're almost inherently much more difficult to prove innocence or at least a wrongful conviction without that silver bullet, so to speak, of having DNA evidence.
Yeah, you really do need a witness to recant, you know, at this point. We need to find someone who would say he didn't do it or someone else to confess to the crime. You know, or to find some huge constitutional error in the case. But, you know, like I said, his attorney was pretty good, and Lynn Neighbors did file appeals on the issues that have been brought up, like the possibility of a mistaken eyewitness identification. The cops basically paraded Isaiah Hill in handcuffs right in front of the witness because Isaiah Hill was staying in the same hotel as the robbery. And, you know, as the prosecutor said, well, they really had to go through the lobby, you know, to bring him to the police car. I mean, I think there could have been ways that could have been avoided. But, you know, the end result is we have a witness who was unsure about who robbed him, seeing Isaiah Hill in handcuffs, you know, march to a police car. So that could be quite prejudicial. But the appeals courts decided that it wasn't. They said that you know, the witness had other chances to see Isaiah Hill, and therefore that alone wasn't enough to overturn the conviction.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for being on the show. The story is The Freedom Files. You can read that at texasobserver.org.
Hey, thanks a lot. Great to talk.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you could pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.